Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee, but it's also a joint hearing with members of the Senate Housing Finance Division, Senator Tomasoni's division, and Representative Karen Clark's division in the House. And we are also welcoming members of the new Legislative Housing Caucus, which I think is, we're very pleased to have established. Senator Mimoy and Representative Karen Clark formed that several months ago, working with advocates on housing issues to form that. And we are forming in the Senate between the Finance Division and this committee, we're forming a new joint housing subcommittee because this issue is so serious. And as we begin to look at it, I think we are all aware of how critical the situation is with the downturn in the economy and the foreclosure crisis, but we have to recognize even 10 years ago, even when we had budget, quote, surpluses, even when we were swimming with money, as we described it, some of the administration people described it, even then there were people who were without adequate housing. I remember one of the advocates telling us about people who come to a shelter at night and they leave early because they have to get to work on time, and the fact that we allow working people and families and anybody to be in a shelter is not acceptable in Minnesota. And so I think this is an excellent opportunity for some of the advocates and people who have been struggling with housing issues to make a presentation to us. I think it should be very educational for all of our committees, and want to welcome you all here. And with that, I'd like to start with calling on Michael Dahl from the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having this hearing, and thank you for being here. I want to give you all in advance thank you for the leadership I know that you're all going to show during this next legislative session to end homelessness. And please know that those of us back here are here to support you and to do whatever we can to help you in that fight. Today's hearing, we're hoping, can accomplish a few things. First, we'd like to talk to you about the causes and solutions of homelessness, something that is going to be the experience of probably over 10,000 men, women, and children tonight. We want to talk to you about services that we can provide to people to help get them out of homelessness, something that we know how to do but lack the resources to do it well enough or for enough people. But more importantly, we also want to talk to you about how to end homelessness, and that's by not letting it happen to begin with. What are the things we can do to prevent homelessness so that it is not a problem for 10,000 people tonight? I'm sure you're all aware of the analogy of the ambulance at the bottom of a cliff, and that if someone is sort of teetering on the edge of a cliff, the best thing to do is redirect them, give them a little bit of help, a little nudge, maybe some supports. The improper response is to put an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff and wait for someone to fall very hard, and put a doctor down there to help repair their broken bones and deal with the emotional stress. The story we're going to tell today is about homelessness. Fits very well into that analogy, and that we're going to have a conversation about how is it that we've allowed homelessness to be the result of what we do to very vulnerable people who are fleeing abuse, who are having an economic crisis, who are dealing with health problems, a host of different issues that are really the core of the problem, but we allow it to become a housing and homelessness problem for them. Homelessness, tonight, many of us are going to be at a memorial service to remember people who died while homeless during this past year. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it's very likely that this year we will be remembering the most people we've ever remembered in a single year who were homeless who died. If it tracks previous years, the ages will be of children under age 1 and up to age 80, people who are working, people who fled abuse, people who died too young because they were homeless. Not even the ambulance got there in enough time to save them. While we're remembering these people who are homeless, it's sometimes easy to think that that's the way it is, that's the way it's always been, and we're going to continue to remember people who died while homeless. But it hasn't always been this way. Prior to the late 70s, we actually had a relatively small number of people who were homeless. The number of people away turned away from help could fit snugly in this room back then. Now the number is over 1,000 who get turned away from services. The number has grown, and it's not because more people have decided they'd like to live a life on the streets. It's because our response to people in crisis has changed. The response that we have to give to people, oftentimes when they call us, is that there's no help at the end.
Stay with me, my boyfriend, and my kid, and we really need somewhere to stay. And I was just wondering, what do you need from us, and if you guys had space?
I'm currently seeking shelter, and I currently have one child who's 10 months old. So if you can give me a call back, I'll appreciate it. Thank you.
I got a call from a family that is comprised of two adults. The adults are mother and daughter to each other, and they have five minor children between them.
I'm a single father with a 14-year-old daughter looking for a place. If you can give me a call back, I can explain it better. Thank you.
I'm currently seeking shelter, and I currently have one child who's 10 months old. So if you can give me a call back at your earliest convenience, I'll appreciate it. Thank you.
I was calling for shelter for me and it's four people in my family because I have to leave this building today.
I need shelter for me and my two children, 8 and 6 years old. Yeah, we are residents of St. Paul, but we are trying to go ahead and reside in Minneapolis.
I'm with my client, Marianne, today, and she has six children, five boys and one daughter, and she is going to be in need of housing as of the 1st of June.
I was calling to see how would I go about trying to get into the shelter. I have three boys, 10 and a half, 8 and a half, and 4 and a half. So can someone please give me a call back?
I'm a family of five, one parent, four children, all under the age of 7. If you can give me a call back, that'd be great. Thanks.
And I'm calling about emergency shelter for me and my 2.5-year-old son.
I'm calling to see if you have any openings for one adult and two children. I'm calling to see if you have any space open for me and my family. It's me, my three children, and my boyfriend. Please give me a call back.
And I'm seeking a shelter. It's me and my 16-month-old daughter.
We are faced with an eviction. We went to court, and we're asked to leave within a week. So there's an eviction that we have to move out of the home. I have two children.
When you get this message, will you please give me a call? I have four kids, and yes, I'm looking for shelter.
I was calling to find out, do you have shelter for me and my two kids, age 7 and 2?
And I'm looking for emergency shelter. It's my husband and my four kids.
This is an illustrated story that we've prepared, and those who
Mr.
are
Weiss,
sitting at that.
Can you identify yourself for the group, and please go ahead then, I'm sorry.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ben Weiss. I'm a board member of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. This is a project that Michael and I had prepared as part of a discussion of how to frame the issue. We have illustrations which are going to be up on the screen, so if you're on that side of the room, you may have a little trouble seeing them. But we wrote this as a picture book for adults, and it's called The Edge. Once upon a time, technical difficulties. Once upon a time, there was a village of people who lived on a patch of green land surrounded by tall cliffs, high above a desert. The village mayor lived securely in the center. But the land was small, and many of the people could only find space on the very edge. As time went on, the wind and rain wore away at the cliffs. In the time of the grandfathers, a wise mayor had led the villagers to build supports so the edges would not crumble away. But over the years, other mayors had allowed the supports to be worn away by the wind and rain, or eaten by animals. Or taken the wood to use for other things. And as the edge crumbled, people began to fall off. Some went over the edge because they were sick. In one way or another. A few people ran or jumped off the edge, and others were pushed.
Can we just have your shell? Okay.
But most people fell because at that moment, are we trying to make it bigger?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. But most people fell because at that moment, they had nowhere else to stand. The good people of the village started building nets to catch those who fell. But there were not enough nets to catch everyone. And some only wanted certain types of people in their net. For those who landed in the nets, it was a long, hard climb back to the top. Some of the villagers strung ladders from their nets to the top of the cliff. But there was never enough rope to make ladders for everyone. And rope ladders twist in the wind and get slippery in the rain. A good doctor went to the bottom of the cliff to fix the broken bones of those who fell all the way down. They could not climb until their wounds had healed, and some would never make it up the cliff again. So the doctor helped them find food and water in the desert. On top of the cliff, the good people of the village tried to keep others from falling. But more and more people still fell, far more than the nets could hold. So the people went to the mayor to ask for help, and the mayor said, "I have a plan. We shall count the people who fall." And the mayor hired a high mathematical inquiring scientist. And the scientist must be told, ordered the mayor, how many people fall head first. And feet first, and back first, and elbows first, and nose first, and knees first, and... The people went back to the mayor, and the mayor said, "I have a plan to end this problem once and for all." and the mayor sent three more doctors to the bottom of the cliff. And the mayor lowered packages of food to the doctors and their patients in the desert. And while the good people of the village argued about who was in the most need of rope, the mountain continued to crumble. The end. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, and members of the committee, I'd like to take a moment to recognize the person who brought this story to life. And I don't need to tell you how great of a job she did, but she did it as a volunteer. She did it faster than I believed physically possible and was wonderful to work with, even though I'm sure I wasn't. Melinda Braun.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we need good doctors who are at the bottom of cliffs to fix the bones of people who fall all the way down. We need those doctors. We need the resources so that they can actually fix the bones of people who fall. We need the nets to catch people because some people will fall off cliffs, but we need the money to actually have the nets for them to fall into. We need ladders so people can get back up to the top, and we need the money so that there are ladders that are actually secure. But more importantly, we need supports. We need the support so people don't fall off cliffs. And we need the money so that we can do that. You each have awesome responsibilities and awesome jobs. You're going into a session when Minnesota's economy and the nation's economy is going to be the worst that we've seen in a very, very long time. And the inclination is going to be that there's going to be less you can do in the time when there's going to be the most people who need your help. We'd like to talk to you just briefly about what it is we need your help on, the different parts of the homelessness continuum, and then after this presentation, open it up for conversation and questions that you have for each of us about how it is we help people who are homeless. I could call Monica.
Go ahead, call people as you wish, and if each person could introduce themselves as they come forward.
We could have the outreach, people who do street outreach in Minnesota, come up.
My name is Brett Byfield. I work for South Metro Human Services and the St. Paul Police Homeless Outreach Project. And 3 years ago, through the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, we were granted $400,000 to do three pilot projects across the state, one in St. Paul, one in Minneapolis, and one in Duluth. 2 years ago, we were awarded $300,000 to continue those projects. What we have learned in that time is, for those folks who have fallen off cliffs, who are chronically in need of services and who become trapped in webs of chronic homelessness, addiction to human services that have not served them and also have become chronically jailed and in detox units, et cetera, is that by bringing human services in partnership with police, we have created partnerships which have created incredible relationships, which we've reached out to provide services which have tremendously reduced recidivism rates for those that we've served. We have folks in long-term housing who are over 93% in St. Paul successful in retaining their housing, and we've reduced detox and arrest numbers substantially by way of creating these relationship partners with our folks on the street who have been trapped in these in this long-standing cycle of chronic homelessness and arrest. And so we are asking for your support. It has been a tremendously powerful program that has, I think, saved a lot of money for the taxpayer. We'd love to continue it.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sergeant Paul Pauls with the St. Paul Police Department and in charge of the Downtown Patrol Unit. This program that's been funded for the last several years has seen a lot of progress and also one of the most innovative programs in the country. We see it because we save taxpayers money. The constant cycle of repeat offenders, whether it's through detox, criminal acts, or just quality of life issues, seem to cease with our new partners. Many years ago, law enforcement providers never communicated. Now we communicate on a daily basis for the outcome of a positive deal. So I see this as a huge savings. I'd like to see it refunded just from the standpoint of the savings that the taxpayers do incur on a day-to-day basis. And I look forward to seeing some of you in the future, and thank you.
Thank you. Not sure who's next.
I think the next group is Shelter.
Thank you.
Monica? Monica? Yes. Maybe you want to have the people who are staying behind you who are doing the outreach workers, maybe they want to introduce themselves, just their names, or you might introduce it for them.
Sure.
Where they work?
Sure. We have...
Hi, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Deb Holman. I work in Duluth as an outreach worker on the street outreach program with the Duluth Police Department.
And I'm Monica Nilsson with St. Stephen's Human Services, working with the Minneapolis Police Department. And our team includes Lam Trung, William Crawford, Essie McKiernan, Patty Patera, who's a community volunteer from Woodbury, Brandon Sanford, David Jeffries, and Erwin Thompson. We've leveraged state funding about $50,000 a year, eightfold. So the difference that the state funding makes in allowing us to seek private, philanthropic, faith community, and city or local funding is tremendous.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please begin by identifying yourselves and who you're.
Good afternoon, Senator and committee. My name is Jim Miner. I'm the CEO and President of People Serving People.
And I'm Leslie Frost. I'm the Executive Director of Families Moving Forward.
My name is Allison Hoberg, and I'm the Shelter Director at St. Stephen Shelter.
This afternoon, we'd just like to take a few moments of your time that I guess in many cases we are the doctors. We are sheltering the families of our communities throughout the state. In our situation at People Serving People today, we have over 300 people that are in our shelter. The most startling statistic of that is that 200 are children. Our average age is now down to 5, including the parents. We are serving these children as members of their families. And as we recognize this evening that we're going to be walking in memory of those that have passed away in the last year or homeless. And last year, we did have a child die at People Serving People from natural causes, but it's a pretty sad day to see a child that loses their life and they're living in a shelter. Their picture is not on anybody's dresser. They're just a lost name at times. So we were very concerned and interested in helping families today to find a way out of this situation. And we believe that by supporting the family, which is one of the most fundamental units of our society, the children in our world are very important. And we have a chance. I looked at each one of you. We have a chance to change what's happening in our community. And one of our greatest opportunities to work with the children. Today when I left our shelter, I looked at children that are 2, 3, 4 years old that are extremely positive. They have a smile on their face, and we need to help leave that smile on their face and give them a chance to change the life that they have been given. And I always want to remind everybody that I have 300 people there. I can't speak to all the adults of why they're there, but I can tell you not one single child has deserved to be homeless tonight.
Senator Marty and members of the committee, the voicemail that you listened to before is from Families Moving Forward. We do our own intake, and people call us over the phone. So those are real voices of real parents and real case managers calling to ask for shelter. In October 2006, we got about 50 such calls, which was pretty standard for us at the time. In October of 2007, we got more than 100. And in October of 2008, we got more than 300 such calls. So our volume of services needed is up 6 times in 2 years. We have not been able to expand our services, so we used to turn down 1 in 25 people, then we turned down 1 in 50 people, and now we are turning down 1 in 100 people who call us for shelter. 300 telephone calls represents 900 to 1,000 people, including more than half of them are children, and more than half of the children are under 6. I have never, in my 16 years of association with Families Moving Forward, known the situation to be more grim than it is right now. But I keep going to work every day because we are good at what we do, and we can help families recreate stable lives, but we are going to need more resources in order to serve more families.
Yesterday I was doing an intake for a client. It was one of our homeless management information intakes. And one of the questions we ask is, where did you stay last night? And he was at Oak Park Heights in the psychiatric unit. And I asked him if he had been offered halfway house placement, and he said no. And I asked, one of the questions we ask is, what is your disability? And he said, I have schizophrenia. And then I asked him about his meds, and he said he had 1 month's worth, and his appointment with the psychiatrist was in a month and a half. He was told by Century Plaza to come to St. Stephen's, and we would be able to help him with that. We have 4 full-time staff, and our job is to run the shelter as well as provide case management for 44 guys. A month ago, HCMC called us about a man who had 2 strokes, and he would need help finding his way to the shelter each day. He had not applied for general assistance yet, and the social worker there asked if we would help him with that. And because Curry Avenue is so overcrowded, he said that the client would be safer at St. Stephen's shelter because we are good at working with vulnerable adults, and that the man probably wouldn't get a chance to talk to a staff person at Curry Avenue for at least a week. We were full, so we pulled aside our dining table, and we set a mat underneath our dining table area after we were done serving food. With regards to single women, when a woman shows up at St. Stephen's shelter looking for a bed, most of the time they would like to stay at a smaller shelter, not on Curry Avenue, because there are hundreds of men and about 80 women staying on Curry. So at 5 o'clock, we have to call CES shelter, and generally I'll have the client call, staff person call, and I'll call. And it's sort of like trying to be the 10th caller on a radio station. However, we need to be the 20th caller. And if we're not the 20th caller, the woman does not have a bed for the night. So we are really in need of more emergency shelter for people, especially with the foreclosures. Currently, we have 5 individuals who are staying at St. Stephen's, men I haven't seen in years because their apartment building was foreclosed on, and I'm expecting more of those men to show up at St. Stephen's. So we cannot afford to have the emergency shelter that we currently have. We need more emergency shelter, and we need more staff. The ratio at Curry Avenue is 1 to 80, and so we just need more staff. Thank you. And we also need more shelter.
Thank you.
Would you like questions at the end, Michael, would you rather at the end?
Can you introduce the people?
Okay. Yes. Are they the next? If you brought, did you have anyone else behind you?
My name is Michelle Nast. I'm with Cornerstone in Bloomington. Cornerstone provides domestic violence shelter, and we have a 35-bed facility. In 2007, we provided safe housing to 189 people, including 55 men, women, and children. Our average length of stay was 32 days. However, there were approximately 70 clients who stayed longer, and of those clients, the average length of stay was 88 days. In 1983, across the state of Minnesota, the average length of stay in a domestic violence program was 11 days. Our length of stay has tripled. In 2007, one of the things that Wilder found out was that 33% of homeless adults reported that they had stayed in an abusive relationship because they had nowhere else to live. Sometimes we ask, why doesn't a victim of domestic violence leave? In 2007, 33% of them had nowhere to go. There was another study in July of 2005 from the Battered Women's Resource Center finding that 59% of women who returned to their battering partner did so because they could not find suitable housing. For victims of domestic violence, not only do we need shelter, but we also need to start focusing really strongly on a place for them to go. Thank you.
Next. Welcome to the committee, and again, please identify yourself.
Thank you. Senator Marty and distinguished members of the committee and valued colleagues, I'm Rick Podvin. For the past 19 years, I've managed transitional housing for the Catholic Charities in St. Cloud. We manage shared living transitional housing for women and children and scattered site transitional housing for chemically dependent recovering veterans, and also am connected with some supportive housing in a social work capacity. My perspective on this is that for the past 19 years, I've been able to go to work every day because I've been able to tell people, my clients, if you do your part, you can get there. I'm beginning to question that. I had a woman a number of years ago who, after having been in our program for 3 weeks, pulled me aside and said, Rick, I got to tell you something. She's 42 years old, two children, 8 years old, 10 years old, and she said something to me that I'll never forget. She said, this is what I always thought a home would be like. And I thought, wow, how great that we can provide that. And also how sad that we need to. Our business with our clients is really all about finding out why do they need us and what needs to happen so it's possible and maybe even likely that they won't need us again. And the part of it that we hand to them and say, this is your part, we call it their homework. This is your homework. And we have our homework as a program. And as a society, we have, I hope, our homework. And in partnership, I hope that we can all continue to work together and make it possible for women like Betty, who said, this is what I always thought a home would be like, to get there and to stay there. And she has. And she keeps in touch. And she says every once in a while to me, tell the people who stood behind us as a program, thank you. So from her and our other clients, I say to all the partners, all the people who are doing their homework. Thank you.
Greetings, I'm LaShella Sims from MICA.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing. Just want to thank the state for being one of the first states to fund transitional housing back in 1984 as a way of moving people out of homelessness back into housing in the community, as well as keeping people from ending up needing the shelter. We serve over 6,000 people a year throughout the metro area, and we turned away 285 people in October and 255 people in November. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, and members of the committee. My name is Alex Nelson, and I work with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless on advocating for unaccompanied youth who are runaway and homeless and exiting the foster care system in Minnesota. So I'd like to ask those who are working with homeless youth and runaway youth to come up now, and then you can I'd appreciate you being here, and appreciate all of you being here, because I know we all have busy schedules. I'll let people introduce themselves and what they do so you can see what that continuum looks like. Do you mind starting, Deb?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Deb Loon. I am the Interim Executive Director at Avenues for Homeless Youth, which is a shelter and short-term transitional housing program in North Minneapolis.
I'm Jessica Hagen. I'm a housing support specialist with RISE. That's about it.
Good afternoon. My name is Susan Phillips, and I work for Lutheran Social Service and programs that serve homeless youth here, primarily in Ramsey County.
Hi, I'm Shauna Jonas. I work as a life skills training coordinator for Lutheran Social Service and a youth and family counselor at the Bridge for Youth as well.
Good afternoon. I'm Denise Shmaya, the director of homeless programs at Face to Face, serving youth in Ramsey County.
My name is Mercy Rocha, and I'm an independent living specialist. I work at the Bridge for Youth, and I also am contracted through Hennepin County working through our pilot program 24/7, which is essentially a preventative program to help our foster care youth to not enter into homelessness. Essentially, what I do is I work with youth as they are about to exit the system and help them to figure out what their education plan is, to help them with employment, and essentially to get them into permanent housing. In the years of my direct service, I have seen that the majority of runaway and homeless youth are from the foster care system. Statistics back up that 70% of homeless youth that have been surveyed they are the youth that are removed from their homes and have spent time in foster care homes and group home settings or treatment centers. Essentially, it is a part of our programming priorities to help equip young people to be independent and learn how to support themselves, so they do not become homeless. However, there is a challenge in doing that because they are very much used to being taught to depend on the system and get used to a culture of couch hopping and living off assistance. I try very hard to help them understand that they are capable young adults that are able to work and go to school and live in their own place. However, it takes a long time to deconstruct that mentality. What we're asking of you is to support the Minnesota Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, as we are in transition of creating more preventative programs for young people like this. And in doing so, what we're asking is for legislators to support two specific agenda items, which is to have automatic enrollment in medical assistance for youth exiting the foster care system so that they would have continuous coverage up to the age of 21, because many youth do not have health care after exiting the foster care system and are unable to enroll because of their housing barriers. The second agenda item we would ask for your support is reentry for supports or services as an option for young people until they are 21 as they exit the foster care system. Since youth aging out of the system may need future support, less than 10% of 18-year-olds live on their own, and 95% of Americans are 25 or older before they're able to even live self-sufficiently. So we're asking for your support in the Minnesota Runaway and Homeless Youth Act so that we can continue to provide shelter and supports as we also help to create preventative services so that they do not become homeless.
Thank you.
I'm Mary Everett from Lakes and Pines Community Action up in Mora, representing, it seems, much of the rural homeless problem here. I am the Community Services Director there. We provide services to low-income people in rural Minnesota struggling to find and keep housing in seven counties. In our 6,000-square-mile service area, the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program grant is our primary funding to work to fight homelessness. We commonly refer to that as FHPAP, and it is a state funding program that for which we are extremely grateful. In October and November of 2007, Lakes and Pines served 61 new households under FHPAP. Of those, 31% were already homeless when they came to us. This year, in October and November, the number of new households jumped to 116, an increase of 90% with no additional funding. The percentage of those who came to us homeless this year reached 48%. Almost half of the people who are calling us now are already homeless. In the last 2 weeks, we've received calls from families losing their homes due to layoffs, medical expenses, domestic abuse, mortgage rate adjustments, and one from fire. Without FHPAP funding, our services would not exist. Our advocates are trained to help the client piece together a plan to get or keep their housing using all the resources that are available. The success is remarkable. The Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program works. After 6 months, 87% of the eligible clients who came to us homeless are in stable housing, and 93% of eligible clients who come to us at risk of losing their housing are still housed 6 months after we work with them. So the money is being well spent. Unfortunately, not all low-income people who are eligible for our program. Because our funding is limited, only people with sufficient income to maintain the housing once we get them stabilized are eligible for our services. The neediest families, those without enough current income to support a household, do not qualify for help. If there were sufficient resources, our counties would have subsidized housing or supportive housing or shelters for all who need them. No one would be living in a car or a fish house or a camper. No one would consider the Walmart parking lot to be their home or the parking lot at the casino. If there were sufficient resources, a person who qualified for general assistance or SSI would be able to find a room to rent that they could afford without having to move 50 or 100 miles away from their hometown, away from the people and places that are familiar and safe. There would be shelters for those trying to move away from a bad situation, be that an abusive home, or a home without heat, or a home without water, or a prison cell. Shelters for anyone needing a safe, warm place to sleep while they find their way, if there were sufficient resources. Thank you for all you have done to fight homelessness. Please try to do more. That's nice.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Martha Eves. I'm a legal aid attorney for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. I've actually practiced 32 years. So I worked under the AFDC program when it was under Carter. I was a part of the AFDC program or practitioner when it was being run by rules created by Ronald Reagan, and now then TANF, and now our revised TANF. So I have a lot of understanding, I believe, of how the system works. And one of the things that I would like to talk to you about today is the emergency assistance system, because that is something that you can really do something about. In Minnesota, during a time when we were in much better financial straits, we put the emergency assistance program into the consolidated fund, and we made it possible for counties then to make up what they considered their own rules for the emergency assistance program for families. I believe that that is a failed experiment, and it is certainly a failed experiment now when the economy has gone amok. What we have is for every county in the state of Minnesota different rules as to which families will qualify for emergency assistance and which will not. And as a result of that, the preventive part, that safety net that was so graphically portrayed in the book, has great big holes in it. And a lot of the services that you've heard talked about today, there would be less demand on those services if we had a well organized emergency assistance program that was directed by the state of Minnesota rather than by all the different counties that we have. I can give you some real specific examples related to the counties that I work in. I work primarily in St. Paul and Washington counties. St. Ramsey County has recognized pretty early that the safety net was falling apart with the new changes in the emergency assistance program, and they created a community safety net committee that meets with the administrators of the county to get feedback from the community about how the EA rules that they have structured are working and not working. And they have been making changes based on that community feedback. That is not so with Washington County. Washington County's emergency assistance program, for example, originally required that anybody applying for that program had to show 12 months' worth of expenses. Now, if you can imagine being in a crisis and being told that you have to come up with your last 12 months' worth of expenses, what happened is people just gave up and they went someplace else for help. Now, Washington County, I will give them credit, they have made some adjustments and lowered that to 6 months. Ramsey County looks back 60 days. Hennepin County looks back 60 days. It makes a huge difference how the programs are operated as to who gets help. And if they don't get help with emergency assistance, they are then going to lose their housing, lose their jobs, and they will be at the doors of all of these services that you've been hearing about. Our office also runs a family homeless prevention program called Project Hope. It is a preventive program in the sense that we work with private landlords and we try to place people in private housing rather than in a shelter or transitional housing because there's not enough transitional housing and shelters to go around. Just in the month of October, the Ramsey County shelter had to turn away on one day 60 families. In our intake, which we do 3 days a week, walk in, no appointments required, we've had an increase of almost 70%. And many of the folks, they simply cannot access emergency assistance or they cannot access housing or we cannot save their housing fast enough. So what we would suggest from the perspective of the Coalition for the Homeless and the legal aid organizations is that we need a statewide program. It needs to be a forecasted program for EA. We are in a crisis. We are seeing tenants who are totally losing their housing through no fault of their own and totally unprepared to face those crises. We need a program that is fair. And Minnesota has always prided itself in its public assistance systems of being a fair program. And yet we have 86 different ways in which the emergency assistance program is being handled. We need a program that is easier to administer. We have rules all over the place from all different counties, and everybody that's served with a legal aid is having more fights with their legal aides about who's eligible and who's not. It's not an efficient program administratively. And we also need a program that's successful. It's not successful to simply show that you've had fewer people getting emergency assistance if, in fact, homelessness has increased in your state. And that's, I believe, what we are seeing the consequences of our preventive systems falling apart. So one thing we would ask of this committee is that you have a forecasted emergency assistance program that is a statewide program and has uniform rules. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster, also with Legal Services, and I'm only here to provide a report to you that we produced last spring that really supports and echoes what Martha said. The need has increased since 2003, since we capped county crisis funds, emergency assistance funds. The spending that counties now can spend arbitrarily as they want to do, and the spending has decreased predictably for county crisis, for families in crisis. So the report supports what Martha said, and we just hope that you will take some time to think about that cliff that Michael Dahl talked about and how expensive it is to deal with these issues when people are at the bottom of the cliff rather than helping them before they fall off the cliff. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Janelle Burton, and I work for the Boyce Fork Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota. For those of you who don't know where that is, it's way north. It's like 60 miles from the Canadian border. It's 18 miles in from any main highway. It's one road in, one road out. And it is 63 miles from any major service area, any social services, any major hospital. Many of our band members are scattered throughout the states. I have a very large service area. I work mostly rural areas in Itasca County, northern St. Louis County, and Coochaching County. Many of our band members that are homeless choose to reside on the reservation and in the surrounding areas, which are very isolated. Many are living in housing that is substandard. They're doubled up, tripled up. I just got a call yesterday of a three-bedroom house that's housing seven separate families. That's a lot of families. I do the long-term homeless program, and I currently have eight slots for eight families or individuals, and those are full. That is subsidy. It provides housing subsidies with supportive services attached. I also have 10 rental assistance-only slots, which we're very grateful for, that can house some families and individuals, but there are no funding for services for these families. And I receive calls every day from people who are looking for help, wanting help that's not available. And if you ever doubt that supportive services is valuable, let me just tell you about a young lady I met 2 years ago. And I say met very, very loosely because I barely made contact with her and then I couldn't find her again. I chased her all over town because she was sleeping on people's couches. She was sleeping wherever she could find. She had four children who were in out-of-home placement, and she was struggling with alcoholism. Over the last 2 years, I have watched these five people go from living very lost and chaotic lives to coming together very nicely as a nice family unit. They have a sober mom and stable housing, and she's actually getting ready to transition off of the program. That's supportive services at work. Okay. They work very hard. They did a lot of hard work on their own, but they also had someone who could provide them with referrals, resources, and just that time, to take that time to support them through some very tough times. What else? I'd like to tell you, I have a lot of success stories, but I guess if I had the time, I'd rather tell you about the people who call and who are wanting help and who are waiting for the opportunity to have some success stories of their own. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Father John Estrom, CEO of Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And at Catholic Charities here in the Twin Cities, we serve about 40,000 people a year. Every night, year-round, about 1,500 people sleep in a bed or on a mat provided by Catholic Charities here in the Twin Cities. And we, like all providers of housing and emergency services, we know that we could easily fill those beds and mats twice over every single night, regardless of the weather. Catholic Charities, we provide a continuum of housing. We provide most of the things that have been talked about, but I'd like to talk mostly about permanent supportive housing. But I'd like to talk about it in a context. Since we do provide emergency shelter, we provide transitional supportive housing, and we provide permanent supportive housing, we see how they all work together. As you have already heard, and as you know, and if you didn't know, you would suspect the number of people seeking shelter and direct emergency assistance has skyrocketed in the last year. We've heard some of those numbers just this afternoon. Some of the numbers for us at just our Dorothy Day Center here in St. Paul in October, if we took the October 2007 numbers and compared them to the October 2008 numbers, the increased number of people sleeping overnight at that facility, 37.1%. If we go back another year and compare October 2006 to October 2008, it's a 50% increase in people coming to sleep on the floor. It's not glamorous. It's a very small little foam mat on a very hard floor. Secure Waiting, which is our emergency shelter in Minneapolis, is full every night. It's over full every night. We don't know if this continues where we're going to put people in either of those emergency shelters. But we think that simply increasing the capacity of shelter alone isn't the solution to the increased need. It may be a piece of the solution, but we have to work all across the spectrum. So we serve families and children, individuals in crisis. We serve people who've just lost their homes and their jobs. Certainly, that's some of the people who come to us. But we also serve a lot of people who have experienced long-term homelessness. And those are the people particularly who benefit from the supportive housing programs. Because the services that supportive housing provides allows clients to get mental health services, allows them to maintain medication, allows them to avoid ending up in our emergency rooms or mental health facilities around the area. Because most of the other solutions, so to speak, cost an enormous amount of money. And permanent supportive housing is not only the best solution, it is the cheapest. So it's sort of nice, I guess, when you can do the best thing for the least amount of money to provide some help. Approximately 67% of our clients, anyway, in our housing programs, self-identify as having mental health issues. 67% self-identify. So it's probably higher. It's probably higher. Most of our clients couldn't function in scattered site housing or in other facilities. They need some assistance. It may just be front desk type of assistance. It may be much more intensive case management services. In many of our sites, not all of them, but in many of them, the average daily cost does include meals, and we ensure that clients get on-time preventative health care, which again is much cheaper than backfilling in the emergency room later. Ignoring people at this vulnerable stage is an enormous cost to society. We don't even need to talk about the moral implications. We can just talk about the financial. We serve people, for instance, in two of our facilities, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, that suffer from chronic alcoholism. These are people who, on average, have failed out of treatment 8 times, on average. Without this housing, the cost to society, just through the increased use of ambulances, emergency rooms, medical detox, and police time, would be dramatic. See, the average cost of a night in detox is $200. We provide supportive service, including shelters, meals, case management, for about $47 a night. If a person is found unconscious on our streets because of intoxication, it's an automatic ambulance ride, pretty much automatic visit to the emergency room, and a night in detox. The cost of that is $1,500 per person per time. We have an excellent relationship with the police, both in Minneapolis and St. Paul. They have lists of people who live at our sites, and they often bring them back to us rather than putting them into this system. A lot of times, the cost to this is billed, of course, to Medicare. It's also often picked up by the hospital themselves, who then passes on the cost to the rest of us. So there's a lot of issues that tie together here, and by providing the supports, we can provide better services, preventive services, stabilize people often, provide them a dignified way to live. Some of them may eventually be able to move on to independent living, and that's, you know, sort of the brass ring in many ways, but it doesn't always happen. And as a society, I think always in the past, we've acknowledged that there are some people who are going to need some supports, maybe possibly for the rest of their lives. We believe that doing it through permanent supportive housing is not just the most cost-effective, it is also the most humane way that upholds the dignity of the person. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Jennifer Sculler, and I'm with the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, based out of Slayton. And we serve about 30 counties of southwestern and south central Minnesota with affordable housing development. I work primarily with our supportive housing program, and I wanted to talk to you specifically about the rental assistance that's part of the whole spectrum of ending homelessness. Affordability is an issue all over, and you know, costs of course are less in greater Minnesota for housing, but our wages are much less as well. In our just in our 18 counties that I work with our continuum of care, our average wages are 46% less than the metro area, and our cost of living is only 31% less. So the gap is just larger for us. So the affordability is important. Our rental assistance program is small. We only have 8 vouchers right now to serve 5 counties for people that have histories of homelessness. And I had 3 applications this week that I may not be able to help them anytime soon. So this is an important part of how we make homelessness end in Minnesota.
Good afternoon. My name is Julie Grothy. I supervise the Delancey Street programs of Guild Incorporated, and we are one of the mobile teams for Hearth Connection. And as part of that, we administer approximately 60 subsidies to the individuals that we serve. I was recently in Milwaukee, and I have to say that I think in Minnesota that we're doing wonderful things with subsidies and with supports. And I was in Milwaukee to talk with housing providers about what we do in Minnesota, what we're doing in Hearth Connection. And what I fear is that if we don't continue to do the housing that we're doing, that we could end up with a situation like's happening in Milwaukee County, where 2 years ago a reporter did an expose called Abandoning Our Mentally Ill, and it was an expose of where folks in Milwaukee County were living and dying in housing that was very substandard. Milwaukee County has decided that housing has to be a piece of their mental health services, and they didn't up until 2 years ago. I believe strongly that we need to have both supportive services and affordability. Of the folks that I serve, none of them could live and afford an apartment in St. Paul without a subsidy. And I believe that all of them would be homeless once again without those subsidies. And they would be homeless and in the ERs. And I'm afraid also some of them would be in jail because they would get into trouble on the streets. So I would urge you to not to continue to fund affordable housing and to make this a major issue, because I really believe that without it, people will continue to die in the streets. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Karen Baldwin, and I work at St. Stephen's Human Services, and we administer about 90 Minnesota housing rental subsidies in Hennepin County, and we use them in private market rate scattered site apartments. And we use them, the subsidies, in a range of programs, and they're extremely helpful and as being a cost-effective and humane way to help people who have fallen off the cliff get back up onto stable housing and then to keep them from falling off the cliff again. Our programs, in partnership with many of the people you see in the room here, work. We have a program that works with people who are homeless an average of 11 years. We use them for frequent users of jail, shelter, and detox. And we also have a program that uses them for young single mothers under the age of 25 to help keep them stable. Our average subsidy is about $500 a month, and so you can just see the savings from having the people be arrested or having to stay in shelter. It's a great, great cost savings and very, very great way to keep them stabilized.
I guess if I could just add one last thing. I know I'm here to talk about rental assistance, but the fact is our rental assistance doesn't work if the services aren't there. And the transitional and emergency shelters, they don't have a place for anybody to go if there's no housing that's affordable after that. And so really it's the whole system that has to work effectively to do this.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that took a little bit longer than I had hoped, but I also want to say that I think that many of us would hope that there were fewer of us, that you needed fewer of us. The homeless system has grown over 30 years because over 30 years we found ways to neglect more and more people, and we've had to have services to help more and more people. And the impression you could get is that we need to fund all of these types of services, but we also just need to stop letting people fall over cliffs. And there's a woman I can see here who is about to say, homeless folks speak for themselves. And you know what? That's true. We need to make sure that we don't let services get in the way of helping people so that they don't have to become homeless. And I ask you to come up.
Thank you for letting me speak for a couple seconds. My name is Sherry Honkala, and I'm with an organization called the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. This is a photograph of myself and my son, Mark, when he was 9 years old. It's an abandoned HUD property that we had taken over many years ago in the Twin Cities because we had tried to get services. And I had to make a difficult decision one night and go into a heated abandoned property to keep me and my son from freezing to death and dying because services were not available in the Twin Cities. And with what's happening in the economy right now, there are going to be many other mothers and fathers who are going to choose to be good mothers and fathers and to not let their children freeze to death and die on the streets of our country. Just a couple other things real quickly. I always have large numbers of people staying at my home. Last holidays, I had 13 homeless people staying in my own home, a Native American family that was homeless, African American family, and a poor white mother who her children had been taken by social services because she wasn't living in adequate housing. And in order for her to get her kids back, she had to show that she had decent housing, and she hadn't been able to get housing. So in order for her to get her children back for the holidays, she stayed in my house, which is a little shoebox. I think it's really important when you have these hearings that I think some of the experts are those of us that have been homeless, that have tried to access the services. We know the ones that don't really work. And we know the ones that are actually there. We know the programs in which people are treated with dignity and as human beings. And it's really important that we don't forget the hidden homeless. And the hidden homeless come from different cultures. We've seen what's happened to the recent COLA program. We also know that the hidden homeless are people that are not drug addicted and that are visible on the streets. They're people that look like me and that, you know, sleep in car or, you know, one couch to another or whatever. And, you know, instead of us being in a situation here in Minnesota where we're fighting over various different crumbs and setting up a situation in which we're having one program compete with another for funds, We should totally have a moratorium on taking any kind of funding away from those of us that have absolutely nothing. We have a country that has plenty, and certainly we can do a better job for Minnesota citizens.
You ready for questions?
Yes.
Thank you to all of you for your presentations. Questions from the committee. I'll start by asking, I think it was Mr. Miner from People Serving People wanted to hear if I...
He's left?
He was saying, the thing that hit me when he said that the average age of their residents at the shelter right now is 5?
Of the children.
He said including adults, I think.
So much that there's parents with a lot of families.
Yeah, 200 children in his shelter. He said, okay. I don't remember if it was a woman from St. Stephen's. Is she still here? Yes, you are. Just was curious if you could, you told us about an individual who I think you said was released from Oak Park Heights the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And could you say that again about how much medicine he had and when he had his appointments?
He had two bottles. They each were different medications, and they were to last him 1 month. And as many service providers in here know, it's over a month to get somebody an intake at the mental health center or the at HCMC. So his appointment was not for a month and a half. And he also, when you go to a penitentiary, you get cut off of your benefits. So he did not have any of his benefits at that point yet either.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I think in the last, it seems like it's been 100 years ago and it was only like 5 months ago. I think in the last legislative session, we changed the language so that when you're incarcerated, your benefits are not cut off, they are suspended. And that should now make it so that at the release date, those benefits can be reinstated without having to go through the big old hoopla that it had been in the past. So,
yep. He does not have to totally reapply. He needs to provide a new address for his check to be sent to, and he also wanted to have a payee, which at this point he needed a doctor's signature to bring to Social Security in order for him to get payee services again.
So,
but yes, that is true, that he does not have to totally reapply, which is very helpful.
Could you clarify what you just said there about that? In other words, in order to get the medical assistance, but in order to get the, what did he have to get a letter for?
In order to have payee services. So
what
he would not.
What does that mean?
When a client cannot manage their own finances, they need to go through an agency, hopefully an agency and not a family member or another person that is from the shelter, but an agency in order to manage their finances and use at least part of it for housing. Not that there's anything wrong with using a family member, but we find at the shelter that it's more helpful to go through an agency.
And, excuse me, Mr. Chair, and did you say that he needed to have a doctor's certificate for that?
He needed to have a doctor's signature that verified he had mental health issues that would require him to have a payee.
Mr. Chair, tell me your name again. I'm sorry.
Allison Hoberg.
Ms. Hoberg, could that not have been done at the institution before he left?
Yes, it could have been done at the institution. However, because he didn't know where he was going to be released to, he didn't have a current address. If he had had a payee, he would have had an address to have his check mailed to his payee. However, I found that in working with individuals who are being released from prison, there is less and less case management done by their parole or probation officers, and so which might be one of the reasons why he was not offered halfway house placement on his exit from Oak Park Heights. But a lot of the work is not done, and we are actually called by probation and parole officers to say, Can you be the address for my discharge? And we're called from all over the state.
Yeah, because Mr. Chair, Ms. Hoberg, I didn't think they would be discharged without an address to somewhere.
Most times, if there is not halfway house placement or program placement for their reentry into the state, they use 1000 Curry or 1010 Curry or one of the shelters as an address. Which, if they are a high-level offender that needs to check in with their probation or parole officer, it's very difficult to locate a client who's needing to, whose address is 1000 Curry or 1010 Curry.
In the rural area, people are released without it. In rural Minnesota, people are released from incarceration often without an address. There are, we don't have an address to give them, so it's not uncommon. I think they say 40% are released without an address outstate.
Is it true that until about a year or two ago that when they were leaving prison, they were not having any meds with them at all? Because
we've changed that. Yeah,
we changed that, I think, but it was until that time somebody's nodding back.
Or like 5 days or something.
Yeah, because the psychiatrist wouldn't give more meds because they weren't able to observe them. Could you comment on that? Is that changed, if you know anything about it?
Getting a month?
Well, we typically have many of our clients in jail, and that is the case. I mean, I think sometimes people come out with meds, sometimes they don't. You know, the letter that she was talking about from the psychiatrist, oftentimes psychiatrists in jails won't do those kind of letters ahead of time. And so you really have to rely and wait. And sometimes psychiatrists won't even do it on the first visit, that they want to know somebody before they're going to make a judgment about a payee-ship. So it's still, I mean, I think it's improved to get assistance right out of jail, but it still can be difficult to get. I mean, Social Security ends when you're in jail, so you might get medical assistance reinstated, but Social Security can take a while.
I can't fix
and
that.
Do any of you have a sense of how many people who are coming out of prison with mental illness have another crisis because they're not on their medications or whatever because of that and end up going back to the state, either prison or hospital or whatever?
Well, currently St. Stephen's is trying to track how many clients we are getting directly from penitentiaries and Anoka State Hospital. And we're also getting lots of letters from clients who are incarcerated saying, I need housing when I am released from prison, so we will be coming to I'll be coming to St. Stephen's on my release date. But I don't have any numbers on that information.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to present numbers, but I just want to point out that the lesson, hopefully, out of all of this is that you're asking shelter providers to quantify people who are discharged from prisons with mental illness and don't have housing to go into. It's a question that those who can afford or have housing, where you wouldn't be asking these questions, where it'd be much more directed towards the individual or their family who is housed about the situation. And that's part of the ridiculousness of how a decision of scarcity places the burden on an undue institution to address the problem. It's ridiculous that a shelter needs to have this expertise.
It's ridiculous that we need the shelters, period.
Right.
Yes. Other questions from the committee? Representative Lane.
I think it was Mary Effort from Mora. Is that her name? You said something about the neediest don't qualify. What do you mean, and how does that work for the neediest?
It doesn't work well for the neediest at all. They are in our service area. We have no shelters. That's not true. The churches in Cambridge will put up families with kids if you can get there. It's 120 miles from the north end of our service area to Cambridge. So our FHPAP grant, which, as I said, we're incredibly great. I mean, we're very grateful for it. It does allow us to serve a lot of families. But because the need is huge and the grant is not, we had to find a way to restrict who would qualify. And the advisory committee came up with a scheme that was, let's use the money where at least if we can get the people stabilized, they have a chance of still being housed 6 months later, which is what we're rated on. Yeah. So if you come to us and you have no income, we can't help you under the FHPAP program. It's a tragedy. It's soul-killing to have to say that to people, but that's what we have right now, so that's what we say.
Another question, maybe, Michael. As the counties, and I came this morning from a county delegation, as they're talking about how we'll get through some of these cuts that'll hit the local governments, as the counties look at being released from some mandates or cutting back on services, talk a little about how that might work with mentally ill or people moving around at the county level.
There are probably others in this room that would be better at answering that question than I, but and maybe I'll use this time to let someone who knows that come on up, but it's sort of a vague question right now because we don't know what mandates you're talking, the state is talking about, or the governor is talking about releasing. I would hope that they would only be mandates that make the system more burdensome on individuals to be able to access services rather than mandates that allow people to get services. Because what we hear in the advocacy community is that those mandates may actually result in fewer people getting served by allowing the state mandates requiring them to serve vulnerable people. And our hope is that that is not going to be the case. If it is the case, you'll just be cutting holes in a net to let people fall through. You're not going to get dramatic savings. To look to the systems that help people who are poor as a place to save money, there have got to be other places.
Follow up on that. With Father Estrom, when we were talking about saving money, could you come back? And I wanted to hear a little more. You had given numbers about $200 a night in detox, and I think you said $1,500 for emergency room, ambulance, et cetera. Could you repeat that again?
Sure. Approximate numbers, they change a little bit county to county and in other circumstances, but basically detox is usually at least $200 a night, the cost to the county. And the cost of an ambulance ride, as I understand it, in most of the metro area, there's a minimum charge of about $1,000. And that's even if you went from here to regions, it'd be $1,000. That's the minimum cost for an ambulance ride. And then you can add to that whatever the emergency room is, $350, $200 for detox, you're up in that $1,500 range. This is one of our programs, but our program does food, shelter, and services for $47 a night.
Which program of yours is that one that you're referring to?
This particular one we were talking about is our, we have two facilities, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, that are for chronic alcoholics. It's a federal disability designation that's very complicated, but yeah, it's for chronic alcoholics, men in both cases. It's a single room occupancy facility with shared meals and shared other services.
Say when we're looking at saving money, those releasing mandates, I always wonder when people start talking which mandates, it always becomes one or two things that don't really make much difference. It just strikes me that if we're this year, I think the expectation in certain offices around here is that these programs will be cut. And we have a choice of cutting them or keeping them the same or increasing them. And it seems to me we're in a problem we're in now because some people cut some things 4 years and previously. And if we do this again, have a lot more medical assistance costs.
Yep. Mr. Chair, that isn't to say that there aren't some mandates that can't be cut. And I do want to honestly say that there are mandates that make it harder for people to access the system, or for us to site housing, or for us to do various things. And those are well worth taking a look at. But I'm hesitant to say that this is a place that you're going to see cost savings, especially if the state is wanting to prove the worth of a program, and so you cut the mandate that allows us to track its success. We'll be shooting our ability to say whether or not the program is successful in future years if we do that in some cases.
I wasn't arguing for cutting or retaining them. I'm just saying that where the money is prevention.
Right.
For the same. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that point about mandates, I would really be interested in hearing back from you on what some of those areas might be that would help you not help the state get to saving so much, but since we can't give a lot of extra money, how might some of the mandates that we require of you unhamstring some of the work that you're doing, or allow you to be able to use your resources with more flexibility, you know, that sort of thing. Since we can't provide a lot of extra funding, one of the things I'm talking to cities and counties and nursing homes and you as a community as well, if there are mandates you're complying with that you would rather have taken off your plate that would allow you increased flexibility in providing services, that would be a really good thing for us to take a look at this year. So mandate does not, in my mind, removing mandates is not simply for to address cost savings, but allow you more flexibility.
Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson-Ropes, I think that we're hearing about getting rid of mandates from a couple of different characters in the how to address the state budget deficit. And so I think it's very important to be clear about what sorts of mandates, because I agree with you.
Right. And then, Mr. Chair, we also have to be really careful when we set aside some of those mandates or waive them for a period, that we're being very careful to examine unintended consequences, because we might free up counties from a particular mandate, and that's just going to, you know, cost shift the problem into your backyard.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Martha Eaves, and I wanted to address the mandate question. That I, not knowing which mandates the counties are talking about, the one that that was changed back in 2003 was consolidating the emergency assistance dollars into the consolidated fund, and then letting the counties decide how much they would and how they would use those dollars. And that's precisely the concern that we have and would like you to change, is there are times when if you remove the state guideline for how money is going to be directed, then it's used for something else. And preventative, you know, emergency assistance is really that money that goes to people who are both on or off welfare, because we have a very fluctuating poverty population, and we always have had a very fluctuating poverty population, at least in my 32 years of practice. When the economy is good, we have lower public assistance populations. When the economy goes in the tube, suddenly we have more people on public assistance, and that's just a reality. So now, you know, we're sitting in this situation where we have given to the counties a consolidated fund and said, draw out of that whatever emergency assistance you need. Well, many counties are saying, well, we're not going to draw emergency assistance out of it, but the way that we'll do it is establish our own barriers to people getting eligible. And so that's a mandate that, you know, I think it's really important that the state put back in, is that we want to have emergencies dealt with. And we want some guidelines as to who, you know, how you're going to do that. And frankly, I think it needs to be, there needs to be forecasted money as to how much counties think it will cost them to actually address the crisis that they're facing, because it is a crisis.
I mean, there's no denying it.
Mr. Weiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. When not writing children's books, I work with Martha at Legal Aid. And to follow up on her point, one of the counties that we work on is Washington County, and I think Martha can tell me the years, but I believe that from 2003 to, I think it was 2007, after the mandates for emergency assistance were removed and they were allowed to use the consolidated fund as they saw fit and to design their own program, I believe there was a 72% drop in how many families received emergency assistance in Washington County. We don't know where those families are going. We suspect that they are ending up in the shelter system in Ramsey County.
I want to, thank you, Mr. Weiss and Ms. Braun, this very nice booklet. I think it very much explains what we're doing and how foolish we're doing is. Every time we're cutting back, we're making things more expensive. And Senator Higgins, maybe you know, I was just curious because when we're talking, one of the women presented from a domestic abuse program was going to ask when we have, I think we have like 30 murders a year, a domestic violence situation often because people didn't get out. When somebody's sentenced for first-degree murder now, what's the average number of years they spend? Do you know how much they spend per year? What's the average per diem in prisons?
I think if we... I think if you included all the costs of the correction system, it's probably $40,000 a year, give or take as a guess.
Well... I appreciate all of you for making the presentations and members of the committee for coming. I wanted to make sure we schedule this on the same day as the Homeless Memorial Service. If any legislators or staff are interested, there's a march that begins at 4:30. People, they have busing from Lake Street and First Avenue South, the Kmart parking lot, 4:15 to 4:30. If you want to just go to the Memorial Service, which is... If I recall from previous years, it's about 100 people who died on the street a year. I have a plaque in my office from a three-month-old who died on the street. 6:30 at St. Stephen's? Or is it Simpson?
Simpson,
South Minneapolis. We can get directions for people who want. And then there's a community dinner there at 7:30. So I would encourage any committee members or legislative staff who can to go to that. And did you have any closing?
Well, Mr. Chair, number one, we will be remembering 130 people, which, if my recollection serves me correct, that's the largest number in the time that I've been working on homelessness issues. If the legislature, if the governor decides to cut programs, you will be asking us to deal with the problems that you are not. Ask that you're not going to take on. You will be asking us to serve more vulnerable people and less vulnerable people in a homelessness system. And so that has to be very clear. You could decide not to support these programs, or you can. The problem will not go away. And so we do need support for the homelessness system. The other side of that is to acknowledge, which we've all heard, that foreclosures are, and the credit crisis are forcing people into homelessness right now, in many ways through no fault of their own. Think of the ridiculousness if you are going through a foreclosure. Is the first question on your mind, I wonder what shelter is open to take me? The shelter system, the homelessness system, should not be the response to this foreclosure prevention crisis. And so I also hope that you do not make cuts. I hope you increase resources for affordable housing, because if not, you are asking us to deal with that problem that no one else is willing to, and we have 30 years of asking our system to answer other people's questions, and that is not fair. It is not right. It is not humane. Thank you.
On that, Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for summarizing that way. I think it's very important to have hearings like this so we keep in mind and encourage our leadership and the governor as well
to not simply deal with the deficit as a math problem. If we just deal with it as a math problem and balancing numbers in columns, it does not acknowledge the impact and the consequence on our streets, literally for you in our hometowns. So thank you very much. I think this is really important.
On Representative Wayne.
I've just been playing around in my own mind about, as we hit this financial crisis, how we approach things. And I just think we need to look more at the idea of what's in our self-interest. This is in my self-interest. This is in your self-interest. And we fight against different interests. And yet it seems to be natural for us to attend to our self-interest. And I would just like to throw that word away, believe it or not, because it seems like a coin. On one side, it's self-interest. On the other side, it's altruism. But in fact, when I look at my body, it's not in my self-interest to keep this hand warm. I mean, it's me. It's not altruism for me to wipe my nose. It's me. And when we look at the fact that all of us are together in one whole, these people that are in need, they're us. It's one whole. And it isn't someone's self-interest for this and someone's other self-interest over here for something else. And it isn't altruism to just take care of this or help out here or there. It is us. It is one whole. And that's how I'm trying to approach some of these questions we have around dealing with the financial crisis and what gets what, where, when. We're one whole, and we need to look at it that way.
Thank you very much. And on that note, we're going to need a lot of advocates here at the Capitol to point out that these are not statistics we're cutting, they're people. So thank you all for coming today and your presentations. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.